Hello, and you are listening to CITR 101.9 FM. This is Democracy Watch. I am dealing with some technical challenges, as per usual. Okay, so this is the News Collective's weekly hour-long news report, bringing you alternative and undercovered current affairs from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. I'm Alex DeBoer.
I'm Andy Laidman.
And I'm Ian Tong.
It's 5:05 on Thursday, July 5th, and we're broadcasting from UBC's Vancouver campus on the ancestral, traditional, and unceded territories of the Hakamino-speaking Musqueam people.
Today on Democracy Watch, we have an updated report on wheelchair-accessible taxis and the role Uber might play in making accessible transportation better or worse for people with diverse abilities. This story features an interview with South Surrey MLA and disability rights activist Stephanie Cadieu, and was originally broadcast on CITR's All Access Pass this February. We are revisiting it today in light of an incident that happened this past Sunday, Canada Day, when a woman was forced to wait 3 hours for a wheelchair-accessible taxi.
After that, we have part one of a three-part series on how the April 2018 passing of the SESTA and FOSTA bills in the United States have been affecting sex workers here in Vancouver. These two bills, which have been collectively referred to as SESTA-FOSTA, are framed as a way to prevent sex workers from screening their clients.
Democracy Watch will wrap up with a short piece on a camp for recently arrived refugee children led by local university students.
So, to start things off, we're going to turn to our first piece produced by CITR's incredible Desi Nair, the former Accessibility Collective coordinator from the previous 2 years. Desi spoke with South Surrey MLA and disability rights activist Stephanie Cadieu about accessible transportation in the Lower Mainland back in February. In light of the troubling situation that happened this past Sunday, Canada Day, when a woman named Merle Smith was left waiting for a wheelchair-accessible taxi for 3 hours. Let's take a listen.
This last Monday, Merle Smith was heading back from Canada Day celebrations in Coquitlam. Leaving the fireworks early to avoid crowds, Merle called for a wheelchair-accessible taxi from Bel Air Taxis. What was originally supposed to be a 15 to 20 minute wait became 3 hours. Her story has caught the attention of many, including the Ministry of Transportation and Coquitlam Mayor Richard Stewart. The Ministry of Transportation has stated that the Passenger Transportation Branch is currently investigating this complaint to make sure the appropriate steps are taken so this does not happen again. Merle is a longtime disability advocate and says that the event was both demoralizing and disappointing. Coquitlam Mayor Richard Stewart was one of the many that waited with Merle and her sister in the rain that Monday evening. Stewart took to social media to express his discontent with this issue, pointing out that the city has had problems in the past with Bel Air Taxi Company. However, this is not the first time there have been issues with accessibility in taxi services within the Greater Vancouver area. Currently, BC has 454 accessible taxis, which make up only 16% of the province's total fleet. In fact, back in February, CITR's Accessibility Collective and I looked into the holes in accessible transportation services offered to the disabled community within Vancouver. We spoke to MLA member Stephanie Cadieu of Surrey South, who has been a key player in the consultation process for introducing Uber to BC. Stephanie Cadieu herself is a vocal disability advocate and is hoping that bringing Uber to BC will better improve transportation options for the province's disabled community. So according to Uber's website, you were listed as saying yes to the question, do you support your party passing new rules to introduce ride sharing to BC in 2017? Is this still true?
Absolutely.
So why are you in support of introducing ride sharing to BC?
Well, you know, we are in a rapidly changing world, and technology is providing opportunities for disruption in all sorts of areas. Sometimes we like the effects of that, sometimes we don't. But one area where we've seen a disruption is in the transportation field with companies like Uber and Lyft and others that have been moving in and operating in cities across Canada, across the U.S., across the world. And people like the service. It's something that Canadians, British Columbians, are asking for. They want to be able to use a service like that. So I think as legislators, it's our obligation to ensure that we create an environment, a legislative environment, in which that can happen, and take into account the things that we want to here in British Columbia to ensure people's safety and so on. But I don't think that it's right for government to stand in the way of progress.
So basically, you were telling us that if ride-sharing services become legal in Vancouver, it will also, I mean, the idea is for it to operate across all BC as well.
Right. So each company that might choose to operate would have the opportunity to choose where they operate, just like A&W or, you know, any other company, right? They don't have to operate, but what we are suggesting and what we would hope is that the legislature would create an environment in which they are able to legally enter the market. And what I think the reality is with some, you know, in British Columbia, we have pretty good transportation in Vancouver. Now, you know, some people will argue with me on that and say, oh, this is terrible and we can never get. But the reality is we do in the major centers have pretty good transportation options. But small communities across our province where lots of people live, including people with disabilities, there aren't a lot of transportation options just due to the size of the market. And if these disruptive technologies and these companies can come in and offer a service that provides options for people, that's good and we should encourage it.
That's right. And just talking about those options, what has Uber proposed you in terms of accessibility? Because we know that, at least in Toronto, in order to make these services available, Uber offers Uber Web, that is a special service for wheelchair users, and Uber Assist, that if the user requests, he can or she can request a driver that has a special training. Meanwhile, in Ottawa, the company, well, agreed to pay like a 7-cent fee for every ride it provides in the city, and right now that is like a collective pool that is destined to be invested in any project related to an accessibility project.
Right. So I think what we're seeing across the world, and certainly companies like Lyft and Uber who have been vocal in our marketplace about wanting to enter the market and talking about their potential services, have acknowledged that this is an area that needs attention and has to be looked at. And in different communities and different places, they're doing that in different ways. And at this point, from the research that I've seen and the presentations that were made to the Select Standing Committee on Ground Corporations that reviewed ride sharing, I would say that nobody's necessarily found a solution that's perfect. But people, jurisdictions are trying things to determine how best to make sure that service is available. In BC here, the Ride Hailing Committee of the legislature that put out its report in February that I was part of, we heard a lot of during our consultations, and we did a lot of thinking on this. And collectively unanimously, we recommended a number of things for British Columbia, that if ride-sharing is going to, ride-hailing, the terms get mixed up, if ride-hailing is going to come to British Columbia, then in terms of accessibility, we want to ensure for British Columbians that we don't see a service decrease as a result, and in fact that we do see service increases. So we've made a number of recommendations. First one is that requiring all ride-hailing companies of a certain size to achieve a service guarantee for accessible service that's equal to their other customers. We've suggested that for all ride-hailing vehicles that are not accessible and are picking up your average ride, that they should be assessed a levy that could be used to enhance accessible services in some fashion, but we haven't decided, we haven't articulated what that might be. We want to ensure that that all of the companies have their apps be accessible, and we want to make sure that drivers have had training, and we've suggested that there's an opportunity to provide ride-hailing companies or ensure that ride-hailing companies provide a sort of a trip bonus to drivers of accessible vehicles in recognition that those vehicles are more expensive, they cost more to operate, and the service, delivering the service to a person with disability can be more expensive in terms of it takes more time to secure the wheelchair in the vehicle and so on. But so I think, you know, we've made a set of recommendations for government to take and take a look at. It's now up to the government of British Columbia to bring in the legislation.
And what has been the reception from Uber Canada with these recommendations?
Well, Uber and Lyft and the other companies that presented and that we've talked to and that I've talked to or have reached out to me all have been, I would say, very open to looking at how do they do this the best way. They recognize they're not, because they rely on individuals with private vehicles, they're not likely to have a fleet of accessible vans show up. But, of course, the reality is as well that not everybody with a disability requires transportation in an accessible vehicle. So, you know, you're trying to balance all of the pros and cons and the options and provide the best service possible. And they've been very, I would suggest that the companies have been very willing to do what's necessary and do what British Columbia thinks can enhance that service and make that available.
BC isn't the first province or even world city to get a ride-sharing service.
Right.
What are some of the, was that kind of stuff that you kept in mind during the consultations, mm-hmm. like learning from other cities? Because I know in the past, for
Absolutely.
Example, there have been some accessibility concerns. It was in New York.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. You know, we took a look at what we could find in the way of data. We asked a number of sort of experts in the field to present their knowledge to us in this regard. And you want to try and build on things that work, not on things that don't. But there may be some things that are unique to British Columbia. As I mentioned in the previous answer, the reality is that in our big cities, we have pretty good service in comparison to other cities. And so we want to make sure that we build upon that and don't sort of cannibalize that with the entry of new providers. So I think that those things are really important. I don't think that there's a, you know, necessarily an easy or quick solution. I think it would take some trial and error to some degree. But I think that the companies that want to operate in British Columbia will see fit to make sure that equitable access is available.
Okay. In October of last year, you tweeted, "It is 2017. Couldn't get an accessible taxi from either of two companies for over 1 hour and a half.
Yeah.
Bring
yeah.
up rideshare. Do you anticipate waiting times will improve for people with disabilities with the help of Uber?"
Well, you know what? That would be my hope, because the reality is that accessible cabs, and in that case, sometimes I use one and sometimes I don't, but in that case, that day I needed one. The reality is that sometimes those cabs are busy transporting people who don't have disabilities and don't require that specialized transport, but they're just, you know, they've got a fare somewhere else. And so my hope would be that if we have ride hailing available and other companies are operating, that more people would choose those options as they are able, which would mean that the accessible fleets would be available for the purpose they were, you know, ultimately intended, which is the transport of people with disabilities.
That's right. Well, and have you used ride-sharing services such as Uber or Lyft in other cities before?
No, I haven't, actually. Mostly because it's fairly new, and frankly, when I've traveled, I've had other transportation arranged, you know, through friends or so on, so I haven't needed it. But I do know a lot of people that use it regularly when they're traveling, including people with disabilities that have really embraced the technology, embraced the idea, and like it. So I think in British Columbia, our hope would be that we can welcome that to the market here and just ensure that people, safety and things like insurance and some regulation are in place to make sure it's an enhancement to our system. And I think that should be the goal.
So kind of going back to the question we asked before about rideshare kind of as like an improvement to the taxi mm-hmm. service or transport services in mm-hmm. BC. We know, you know, with taxis in Vancouver, there can be a longer wait time. The drivers might not be, completely understanding mm-hmm. to someone with a disability. Mm-hmm. And then we have like Handy Dart, for example, whose services right. were, you know, they're lobbying to improve. Mm-hmm. There's a big concern with these kind of services reaching out to rural communities mm-hmm. where there are people with disabilities who would need these kind of transport services. Has Uber said anything, or has that kind of been addressed through the consultations?
Well, I would say that, first off, you know, in an enhancement of the service, that is ideally what it is, right? We have a good transportation model or conglomerate, whatever you want to call it, in Vancouver, for sure, and in the major centers like Kelowna or Victoria. In the smaller centers, it's more of a challenge, and sort of any option might be an improvement over, you know, the fact that some of these communities don't have taxis at all, never mind accessible taxis. So there's that. But I think it's important to remember, too, that we're talking about, you know, bringing in an option and another transportation option to enhance the system for all people, and all people of all disabilities disabilities. And some of those people, could see other benefits from the introduction of a service like this, in that it could be an employment opportunity for somebody who's deaf or hard of hearing. Perhaps they may choose to drive an Uber or drive for a rideshare company. Others, people with disabilities, seniors that require a little assistance to and from their destination, may find that some of the services offered by a company like Lyft has offered in other communities, where they have sort of an enhanced service where the driver is trained and assists, those things could be really beneficial. So I think that's the opportunity that exists, and whether or not companies deliver on the promise of good service and so on, really is left up to the market.
No, and competition is always good in the sense that it will make already established taxis companies to improve their services towards people with disabilities, right?
Right, and I think we need to always be encouraging all. We're not there yet, right? I mean, we need to encourage all businesses to improve their understanding of disability issues, understanding of how to best serve customers with all different types of disabilities, how they can improve their workforce by hiring people with disabilities and welcoming people into the fold. We need to continue to do that. It's not done. It's not complete. It's barely started, in my opinion, and we need to continue that. We need to continue to encourage and demand, to some degree, that people have access to and are required to take training in these issues. And that would include people with disabilities learning about other people with other disabilities that are unlike themselves. So I think, you know, opportunities like you have on the radio to share these kinds of challenges and opportunities are fantastic. And I think that as legislators, we have the opportunity in Victoria to ensure that the law reflects that as well.
Why do you think BC has waited so long to bring in Uber and other ride-sharing services?
Well, I really don't know on that entirely. I think, you know, the reality is that when anything is new, there are early adopters, there are people who right away are comfortable and engaged and you know, sort of trialing and learning. And then there are others who are standing back saying, oh, I'm not sure about this. Oh, it's a fad. It'll pass. You know, the reality is that there's always people on all ends of that spectrum, and that would be the same in your government. You have people from all ends of the spectrum in your government. So I think to some degree, these things take time. There's also the reality that in government, there's always a more work to be done than there is time, and so things take priority or precedence over other things. You know, I think all three parties in the legislature have expressed a desire to see ride-hailing in the province. Our party promised to have it in by December and had a bill prepared. The NDP, when they took power, said that they would have it in by December and didn't meet that timeline. Instead, they referred it to a committee for more discussion and hired a consultant to do a review of the impacts on the taxi industry. So, you know, we're waiting now and encouraging now that the NDP government move and get this legislation in place. We've provided, the committee's provided a report with all sorts of recommendations in how to get that done, and now I think it's important that the government do it and meet their commitment that they made to voters. But I certainly don't think that that there's, at this point, any sort of apprehension, really. It's now just a matter of getting it done.
We reached out to Twitter to ask, what are people's thoughts mm-hmm. on Uber coming? And so kind of with that, for the last two episodes, we've been doing things on share companies. And I think with the idea of share companies, sometimes people feel that there's kind of that because it's a share company, because it's a private company, there's not as many regulations or
mm-hmm.
put out. So what would you say to people who would, you know, like, oh, Uber might not be as accessible because there's no there's right. no one monitoring?
Well, and that in fact is why at this point it's not legal in British Columbia for them to operate, and why government, all parties took time to think about this, and frankly why we will look to introduce legislation, or the NDP government now will look to introduce legislation, I would expect, to allow them to operate. But in doing so, that sets out the regulation, the regulations and the terms under which they can operate, and the rules, the law for that. And we can take into account those things that people are concerned about in terms of safety, in terms of oversight, in who's going to monitor these companies, who's going to monitor that they are operating the way Canadians expect, or British Columbians expect. That is the role of the legislature, to provide that structure.
You were also mentioning about the data and how the data that Uber can access through its future riders and from the riders that they are having right now will benefit, I mean, the society. Have you talked with Uber in terms of, okay, how you can leverage that data that you're going to be gathering right. in order to improve the transportation services in BC?
Right. Well, it was actually an issue that we discussed a lot in the committee, because the reality is, you know, we're making a lot of assumptions. And the companies themselves, in their promotion of their ability to operate, are making a lot of assumptions about things that will or won't happen. And there, you know, there are members that believe strongly there's a challenge here in terms of more cars on the road. Others don't believe it's going to add cars, but actually believe it could actually, just provide a benefit that's needed. So one of the opportunities is for that data to actually be compiled and shared openly. And so that one of the recommendations, or actually multiple recommendations of the committee, relate specifically to data and to the fact that if companies are going to operate, that government should have access to the data.
I think we're about to end off here. I just wanted to ask you one last question. What have been your personal thoughts after coming out of these rideshare consultations? I know it's been quite the process.
Yeah, it was. It was a fun process, though. It was interesting, and I think, you know, there are always, with any new technology, any decision government broadly needs to make, there are pros, there are cons, there are things that will be good, and there are consequences and unintended consequences that one has to consider, and you do your best in pulling that all together. I think that this provides an opportunity. I think it's a way that the world, society is moving. And like other things in the shared economy. You know, there will be some things that work, some things that turn out to not be so good. Just like social media, right? Mm-hmm. There's a lot of good things about social media. There's also a lot of things that aren't so good, as we've seen, and certainly is very public right now in the States. So, you know, I think the reality is that what I came out of this with is that this is potentially an opportunity to enhance services for British Columbians broadly, and that there's a real opportunity to leverage their introduction to benefit people with disabilities. And so that's my hope and my goal.
That was MLA member Stephanie Kedu talking to Patrizio from CITR's Access Collective, as well as myself. Just this month, Premier Horgan announced that his government would likely not be able to meet their promise of introducing ride-hailing services, including Uber, by this Christmas. This is definitely something to keep an eye out for in the coming months, to see whether or not services like Uber will be able to come in and improve transportation for BC's disabled community, and possibly, hopefully, avoid incidences like the one Merle Smith went through this last Canada Day.
Listening to Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM, the News Collective's weekly local current affairs show. You just heard a piece on the state of accessible transportation in the Lower Mainland featuring South Surrey MLA and disability rights activist Stephanie Kedu. We're now turning to a story on how America's new SESTA-FOSTA bills have been affecting sex workers here in Canada. Take a listen. And you're listening to Warning, Back Page Not Found.
On April 11, 2018, the United States passed the Stop Enabling Sex Traffickers Act and allow states to fight online sex trafficking act into law. The two bills grouped together and referred to as SESTA-FOSTA are framed as a way to prevent online sex trafficking, but in reality are causing many problems for sex workers in the United States and internationally, as US-based websites like Backpage were seized under the new law. My name is Sammy Smart, and together with Andy Laidman, we conducted a series of interviews investigating the real-world effect of the legislation on Vancouver sex workers. I reached out to PACE Society, a Vancouver-based nonprofit dedicated to harm reduction for sex workers and community education. I spoke to Caroline Dirksen, a community educator at PACE, about how SESTA-FOSTA is affecting Canadian sex workers. This is part one of a three-part series. With SESTA-FOSTA getting passed in the United States, how is that going to affect Canadian sex workers who used Backpage and other similar websites for screening clients?
For sure. I think because SESTA and FOSTA is quite complicated, and because it has a lot of base in the United States, of course, people are really wondering how this is affecting folks in Canada and how it will affect Canadian policy and legislation overall. And I think it's really important, even before we get into FOSTA SESTA, maybe just to give your listeners a little bit of information about what the current laws are in Canada. Mm-hmm. That way people might have a better understanding of what's really happening. But essentially, so I'll just get into that briefly, mm-hmm. but what workers are working under in Canada is called Bill C-36. And this is the Protection of Communities and Exploited Persons Act. This became law in December of 2014. This was implemented by Conservative Justice Minister at the time, Peter McKay. And this bill was created with the intention of eradicating sex work, basically with the idea if the demand for sex work is reduced, then we can abolish sex work and all the issues are gone. And that is so not how it works. The folks who created this bill made the assumption that if clients rather than sex workers are criminalized, they would create a better relationship between police and sex workers, because under this bill, it's legal to sell sex, but it's illegal to purchase sex. Mm-hmm. So the thought behind that was that if you know, sex workers aren't the ones being criminalized, then it will solve a lot of the issues. But what I try to remind people is that it doesn't matter whether or not the client or the sex worker is the one being criminalized. At the end of the day, when there is that criminal element to it, you know, stigma still exists and thrives. It creates a more antagonistic relationship between police and sex workers and other authorities as well. And really, it comes down to, you know, sex workers having to keep clients, you know, safe, because it's not just sex workers who have to be concerned about safety, but it's like the safety of the client as well, and the client not being caught. So this is kind of what we're working under in Canada. And so with the introduction of CESTA and FOSTA, so CESTA stands for Stop Enabling Sex Traffickers Act, and FOSTA, which stands for Fighting Online Sex Trafficking Act. So essentially what these what this does is it packages it together, two laws amending section, the 1996 section 230, which is Safe Harbor portion of Communications Decency Act. So this previously protected websites from being held accountable for users' content. So now what's happening is that CESTA FOSTA holds domains accountable for what people are posting on their websites. And this is why we saw the closure of Backpage. Essentially what was happening is that it was conveyed that this is a site that sex traffickers were using, and then it was shut down. So this is happening to not just sites like Backpage, but it's happening to sex workers. For example, Google accounts are a big one that's being deleted right now, so a lot of information is being lost, websites are being taken down without any warning, people are really scared about where their information is ending up. And really the impacts of this is, like in the U.S., Canada is going to experience a smaller client pool. There's less access to potential clients and clients. There's a hindered communication between sex workers when there aren't these platforms that exist for communication. You know, that avenue is lost, and that method of communication is no longer there, which is a great way for sex workers to communicate about clients, to keep one another safe and all that stuff. So overall, what is happening is CESTA and FOSTA is creating a less safe working environment for those in the sex industry.
So with that, are there currently any Canadian-based alternatives to Backpage or other similar websites that allow sex workers to screen people before meeting them and all the other benefits that it had?
There are. Backpage was definitely one of the staple websites, and it was a very devastating closure for folks in the community. Backpage was really great because it was accessible to a lot of people. And the more and more sites that get closed down, the more options, the less options, I mean, are available. So while Backpage is closed and Craigslist is going through shifts as well with how folks can promote and advertise, there are websites, for example, Leolist. It's a really prominent website used by Canadian sex workers, and it's actually Vancouver-based. So while technically folks aren't supposed to be advertising on this website, Leolist, it's just not on the same radar in Canada as it is in the United States. If Leolist was based in the United States, I do believe that it would be shut down or be on the radar. So folks are using Leolist, and, you know, people have to get creative as well. There's different avenues like dating apps that people can meet clients through. There are different cuddling apps, actually, like for folks to meet up and cuddle, but then there's more that happens so people can reach clients that way. There's different ways to, like, advertise yourself on Craigslist without getting, you know, detected, or certain acronyms or words will get detected and your account will be shut down. So there's ways to be creative in your wording and your messaging. But it takes a lot of, time, and, you know, it does cost money to post your advertisements and whatnot. And because people are flocking to more limited websites, the demand to keep putting money to boost your ads is a thing. So of the sex worker community, the most privileged of sex workers will be at the top list for advertisers because there's access to money and you can put that into your advertisements, whereas certain sex workers might not be able to afford the rate to advertise and to afford to boost their posts all the time so that they're visible, and that's the issue.
So with that in mind and like legislation related to it, do you think that SESTA and FOSTA will have any influence on how the Canadian government and lawmakers approach sex work?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question and a question that I've been thinking about as well. And I think a lot of people based in Canada are thinking about, because this is happening at quite a rampant rate. I mean, just personally on my Twitter, I am constantly seeing posts from other, you know, workers warning others about, like, shutting down of websites, how to stay safe, how to communicate still. And it does, you know, bring up the issue of what's going to happen in Canada. I think something that is positive right now is that the young liberals are actually advocating for sex work decriminalization. And that's something that's going to be on their national platform and something they've brought forward as an important issue. And I'm hoping that that might resonate with the rest of, you know, the Liberal Party, because Justin Trudeau isn't really our greatest ally right now. So I hope that the young Liberals can, you know, get that messaging out and, you know, spread the word and spread the message about why, like, decriminalization is important and, like, knowing the facts and, like, staying, you know, critical of, like, the media we're consuming, because really in Canada, our legislation right now is based upon incomplete information, and I don't want that to keep happening. I think that, yeah, if the young Liberals can continue to push the message, if sex workers can continue to push the message, and advocates and organizations, I hope that we can shine light on this issue and shine light about the fact that there's so much conflation about human trafficking and sex work, and that's really what SESTA FOSTA comes down to, is a lot of misinformation. And I just hope that in Canada we can keep the conversation going so laws and policies like this don't continue to happen.
Absolutely. And what can Canadians do in general to ensure the safety of sex workers, like locally and globally?
For sure. I think just to go back to some of the points I just mentioned, I should have saved this for this question, but what I always tell people is, even when you're consuming, you know, mainstream media that seems to be really credible, just check your sources. Find out if this is evidence-based research that you're reading. Stay critical of the media you're consuming. Like, reach out to niche media, like media like yourself, who are covering stories and topics and voices that aren't necessarily amplified in our mainstream media. And talking to sex workers and amplifying sex worker voices. I think there's a really great hashtag out there, Not About Us, Without Us, and that comes from the disability rights movement in the 70s, and a phrase that the sex worker community has used a lot. And I think it's really telling, because if you're doing, you know, any kind of policy creation or whatever, I think it's so important for the folks that it affects to be involved. And I think sex workers do need to be a part of these conversations at the table and, you know, be in the room with politicians and policymakers. Yeah, and I think that the biggest thing, too, is always to fight and advocate for sex work decriminalization. I think that a lot of the issues we're having, you know, in Canada and actually in different parts of the world come because sex work decriminalization isn't a reality. And I suggest that if folks are, like, curious about this, just to check into New Zealand's model. They're actually the only country in the world that has decriminalized sex work. And that happened in 2003, I believe. And the stated goals, such as that we have in Canada, the goal of, you know, repairing relationships between the sex work community and the police, for example, for creating better working conditions, for giving people access to health care, all these different things come with sex work decriminalization. And I think that sex work decriminalization not only helps folks involved in sex work, but it definitely helps people who have been trafficked. And that's something that isn't talked about enough, and I think that it needs to be a topic that, you know, is out there and we're talking about in our everyday lives.
At Dunkin' Donuts, each and every radio show
is brewed fresh and served fresh at the peak of its flavor. If you're a tough customer, only the taste of this
radio show
will do. So go ahead, let Dunkin' Donuts make your
radio experience
exquisite.
Indeed.
Dunkin' Donuts, serving sweet treats from the Pop Underground. Thursdays, noon to 1.
We don't need to tell you that Vancouver has a housing problem.
Mass evictions.
Mass rent evictions.
Unfair rent increases.
What happened to rent control and protection from unfair eviction?
If these or other housing matters concern you, you may be interested in joining the Vancouver Tenants Union. For more information, visit tenantsunion.ca.
Tune in every Thursday from 11 p.m. till midnight for Copy and Paste with your host, Tim, a.k.a. Autonomy, the very best in underground dance music.
All right, thanks for listening. You're still tuned in to Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM, CITR's weekly local current affairs program brought to you by the News Collective. My name is Andy Laidman, and I would just like to thank Carolyn Dirksen from Pace Society for agreeing to speak with us and providing us with her valuable input on the subject.
So, Andy, thanks for being with us. Thanks for sharing this piece as well. Unfortunately, Sammy, who conducted the interview, isn't here. But I just wanted to ask you, because you and her, I know, are working together on this project, and as you mentioned in the piece we just listened to, this is part of a three-part series. Could you tell us again what that's called and what it's about?
Yeah, so it's called Warning Back Page Not Found, and it's about how the passing of Sesta Fosta in the United States has affected Vancouver sex workers through being unable to advertise using the mediums that they were using, notably Back Pages, but it has also affected Craigslist as well. It's really interesting. So as you said, it's a three-part series with maybe a bonus episode, so Ooh. Stay tuned for that.
a three-part series with four episodes, maybe.
It's like a bonus track on CDs, right?
Yeah, no, totally. That's awesome. I really like the title also.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting because I had not heard of Backpage, but can you tell me more specifically about how Sesta Fosta, these two bills, are affecting Craigslist here in Canada, and like, how do sex workers use Craigslist? How is that an asset to them, or how does that keep them safe?
Yeah, so Craigslist wasn't as like valuable a platform for advertising. A lot of it was done on Back Pages, but what's happened is with the passing of the bill, which is designed, the two bills, which are designed to combat sex trafficking, they no longer, like, they are targeting websites that had like personal ads for, you know, for selling sex or massage or anything like that in an effort to stop sex trafficking. But what it did was it took away these mediums from people that are doing sex work willingly, that are using that as their primary method of gaining income. And without having this, you know, established platform where they can advertise, where clients know to look, it's caused them to not be able to receive as many clients, even if they are able to advertise on a different medium. It's also one of the main concerns with it is that there's a couple of main concerns. One is that without this accessibility, a lot of people are being driven back into the streets.
Mm-hmm.
And they're being driven into the arms of either pimps or people that are very manipulative that can guarantee them clients. And with using Backpage, it was really gave them like a bit of autonomy, a lot of independence. It enabled them to screen and to really be able to like make their own decisions and what kind of clients they would see. And a lot of that's been stripped away.
Okay. Yeah. So I want to ask you a bit more about the series itself and the reporting and interviewing and research you're doing. Do you know who you'll be featuring in the next couple episodes, and do you want to share that, or are you still in the process of deciding?
Yeah, so the next few episodes, I spoke with Haley Heartless, for one, and she's a local sex work activist.
Okay.
And she had some very valuable insight about particularly how it's affecting the trans community. I also spoke to a woman named Carmen. She as well is a sex worker. She does a bit of activism as well, I believe. And so she had a different perspective on it as well, because she does different work than what Haley does, and kind of like two sides there and how it's affected both of them. And the bonus episode, I'm not so sure about yet. So
the bonus episode remains a mystery. Yeah. That seems fitting.
Yeah, build the suspense, right?
Yeah, totally. And then, yeah, is this series going to be available to download once it's done? Or what's the situation with that?
Yeah, so it'll be available as a podcast. Still figuring out how to, yeah, the how mediums to set that for up. That. Yeah. But
yeah.
It will be as a little mini series. And also on CITR's website.
Yeah. Cool. That's awesome. I look forward to hearing more.
Thanks, Alex.
Cool. Well, once again, you are listening to Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. We cover local undercovered issues and ideas, and we are a group of CITR members that make up the News Collective. So stay tuned. We have one last story for you before the end of the hour. We're just going to go to a couple fun promos.
Support the women of the Downtown East Side and spring into the Scotiabank Charity Challenge on June 24th. Join the Downtown East Side Women's Center in crowdsourcing funds and spreading awareness of their organization, which provides safe space, emergency shelter, basic essentials, and a continuum of support to marginalized women. Go to www.dewc.ca/run-4-DEWC for more information.
Discordianism is a religion and subsequent philosophy.
The Discordian faith seem to be much more forgiving of the normals.
Yeah, the goddess of chaos, or archetypes, or
ideas. It's got a really heavy interest in Discordianism.
Founded after the 1963 publication of its holy book, The Principia Discordia.
Discorder magazine has been Vancouver's longest running, free, badass, independent magazine, 35 years strong. On Saturday, July 21st, celebrate 401 issues of Discorder magazine with an all-ages party at Red Gate. There will be performances by BB, Francesca Belcourt, Morning Coo, and The New Rituals, guest hosted by Dunkin's Donuts, and featuring a photo booth, giant twister, and more. Tickets are a suggested donation of $10 and doors open at 8. For more information, visit CITR.ca or find the event on Facebook.
It's a responsibility for every human being around. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not easy for a kid to come from a place of war to a new place and stay at home, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, stay at home, do nothing, he has no friends, nothing to look out for. You know, they fall into depression sometimes. I've witnessed this. They fall into depression, they feel lonely, psychological, mental health problems that arise. Mm-hmm. But we're here to help make this better, you know. Get them out of this thing and help them become kids.
That was Haytham Alamadeh, a fourth-year UBC biology student and recruitment director for the newcomer camp. He spoke on the significance of the camp's mandate and their fundamental goal of teaching newly arrived refugee children the English language, giving them the opportunity to play a variety of sports, and establishing them in a welcoming community. The camp is also vital for integrating a proper schooling curriculum and a daily schedule for the refugee children to get used to when they go back to school in September.
Another key component is to introduce to the kids rules and structure. For example, how the day is structured with breaks and class time and outside time, but then also how the class is structured in terms of like quiet time and when you can speak and when it's whose turn to talk and that stuff.
Besides familiarizing the children with the formal education system for school in September, children interaction is also one of the major elements that the newcomer camp intends to promote.
I mean, the biggest thing is just like learning how to interact with our children. A lot of the kids, because of their situation back home or in refugee camps in Lebanon and Jordan and similar areas, they don't really have experience interacting with people or other children outside of their immediate family. And so there's kind of like a they're not really familiar with how to positively interact with their children, how to make friends. And that's a big part of what we're trying to accomplish here, is kind of like make them comfortable with interacting with their children. Because when they enter school in September, that's going to be a major hurdle if they're not capable of interacting.
Conditioned in refugee camps and having lived unspeakable experiences, the BC Newcomer Camp's location is also one of the fortunate aspects which makes this initiative even better.
I think, especially BC, you know, Canada is one thing, but BC is just such a wonderful place. I'm not from BC, and actually when I came to school here, I wasn't anticipating how great it was going to be to live by the oceans and the mountains, to have all of that, you know, the full summer and the full winter here. So I think BC is somewhere that a lot of people could really settle down in and be really happy here.
Currently, founders Dakota Koch and Duncan Bernardo are still trying to reach their fundraising goal of $30,000. With monetary assistance already given by the federal government, Koch and Bernardo still require donations for the camp's expenditure on transportation, food, equipment, facility rentals, and insurance. The BC Newcomer Camp is being operated in both East Vancouver and Surrey, and they hope to expand further.
We try our best to get them moving, to go running, to go play around, to be, you know, like, to be themselves. But it's hard. They've seen a lot. And without the people's support, without their presence, and, we can't do anything to those kids. You know, it's all about the people working together and sticking together and reaching out to those kids that need us now.
If you'd like to donate to the BC Newcomer Camp, you can go to their website www.bcnewcomercamp.org/donate. You would be positively affecting the lives of newly arrived refugee children in Vancouver while helping the charity reach its fundraising goal of $30,000. Thanks for listening. Please stay tuned in for more awesome content by the News Collective at the CITR on 101.9 FM.
All right, and that was our final piece by Aiden Tong, our wonderful News Collective member. And this is the end of Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. Thank you for tuning in. And please tune in again next Thursday. As well, I would just like to say that we have a new municipal politics, and specifically municipal election podcast, called Seeking Office. You can download it on iTunes, and it will soon be available on Android apps as well, like Google Play. We're just getting that set up. Right now, there are two episodes available. One is an interview with Kennedy Stewart, who is an independent running for mayor and who is leading in the polls. And I interviewed him and pressed him on why he has not spoken out against mass dem evictions happening in his riding in Burnaby, because he's also an NDP member of parliament. So that's the first episode. And we also have another episode up on the Green Party nomination meeting that happened on June 27th. So check out Seeking Office when you get a chance. And thank you again for listening to Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. Stay tuned for No Dead Air coming up next.